Good morning and welcome. I want to extend a warm welcome to those of you who are visiting with us, perhaps some of you even for the first time. We hope that you are feeling comfortable in the assembly and that the things that we're doing together have been uplifting to you, encouraging to you. I appreciate very much Steve singing the song that he just sang, chosen specifically to complement what we're going to be talking this morning, studying about, and that is our physical blessings, and the title I've entitled, or sermon I've entitled, I'm So Blessed. I think Bob may have gotten it wrong when he talked about why it had to be so early. 6 o'clock is late for a baby. How many babies are born in the middle of the night? My own son, particularly David, was born at 1:20 in the morning. 6 o'clock would have been wonderful. But of course, agree with Bob and what he said. We need to remember Laura and Gina, and Vincent and Linda and others of our number who are going to be dealing with health difficulties this week. Pray that their progress will be evident and that they'll have good results. It is said that a picture is worth a thousand words. Even the most eloquent speakers have difficulty competing with the visual effects of some pictures. And in fact, technology has made us a very visually oriented society. Between computers and theaters and television, we prefer to see things in many cases, than to read about them. And so some pictures, like the ones you've been looking at so far, remind us of the beauty of nature. And I offer thanks to Jack Runt, who supplied me with a number of the pictures that I'm using this morning to illustrate these points. Other pictures, equally as vivid and as powerful, speak to us of the power of God in nature, in the world around us. Some pictures are whimsical, even humorous, and they evoke in us certain emotions of wonder and amazement, that sort of thing. And some bring out other emotions. The picture you're looking at right now, I posted a few weeks ago, or maybe a couple months ago, on the Preacher's Corner with the text that accompanied the picture when I came across it. Apparently what had happened in the situation here was that this fireman had been called to a house for a house fire, and he had rescued this Doberman in the picture, a pregnant female, and had carried her out of the house and then gone back to fight the fire. And then, wearied by his efforts, he comes out, he's sitting on the front lawn of the home, and the Doberman approaches him. According to the text, he wasn't very familiar with Dobermans, and so he was a little unsure about what she was going to do. And the photographer captured the moment when the Doberman came over and kissed him on the face. You like to think we often assign human emotions, or emotions that we typically associate with humanity. We assign those emotions sometimes to animals and to our pets, and I'm not sure that's invalid. And one gets the impression, looking at that photo, of the possible thanksgiving on the part of the dog. Another photo that I've run across. A beautiful photo. The contrast in the size of the hands reminds you of the strength of parents and the frailty of an infant child. And you see the parent holding the hand of that child, and it reminds us of how we parents want to protect and to provide for our children, our very small children, when they come into this world. And then there are other photos, that pictures that bring out other emotions in us, emotions that are not all that happy. Emotions of horror and anger and even sadness. The pictures you just saw were from the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, as I'm sure nearly all of you, if not all of you, are aware. Those photos, when they first appeared in the news media, were so emotionally wrenching that the media quit showing them right away. It stirred America up to see, not just to hear, but to see the things that had happened in New York City on September 11th, 2001. I recently ran across another photo, a photo that stunned me. And I'm going to show it in just a moment, in a few moments. But it is an emotionally disturbing photo. And I will warn those of you who have small children that you may not want your child to see this photo. I'll tell you before I reveal it. But I will warn you, you may want to occupy your children, or if you want to take them out just briefly, I'll tell you before I show you the photo. But I will tell you that I have rarely been touched as deeply by a picture as I was by this particular photo. The photographer who took this picture a number of years ago, the picture was actually taken in 1993, won a Pulitzer Prize for feature photography for this particular photo. And because of the impact that it had on the entire world, it shocked the world. I don't remember the photo in 1994 when the award was given to this photographer. And I want to show you the photo just briefly. And then I want to talk to you about how it affected me and what I learned from it. What we're going to do this morning is we're going to talk about how we view our own physical blessings. We're going to talk about how we ought to use those blessings that we have. I appreciated the prayer that David led. He mentioned, David Dunaway, mentioned in the opening prayer how blessed we are. And that's certainly the truth. And Noble likewise, before we had the opportunity, or as we were given the opportunity to lay by in store to give of our prosperity, he likewise noted how fortunate, how blessed we are. I want to talk to you a little bit about this photo. It was taken by a man named Kevin Carter. Kevin Carter was a South African, a photographer by profession. And when I received the photo, it was accompanied by some text that disturbed me. I want to show you the text because I want you to see that the text gives the wrong impression about the photo, makes it even worse than, of course, it is to begin with. The child in the photo is a Sudanese girl, a young girl, obviously. Sudan in 1993 was in the grip of a famine that was caused in part by civil war and probably other factors. The text that was shown, or that came with the photo, was this text on the screen. The photo in the mail is the Pulitzer Prize winning photo taken in 1994 during the Sudan famine. The picture depicts a famine-stricken child crawling toward a United Nations food camp located a kilometer away. The vulture in the picture is obviously waiting for the child to die so that it can eat it. This picture shocked the entire world. No one knows what happened to the child, including the photographer, Kevin Carter, who left the place as soon as the photograph was taken. 3 months later, he committed suicide due to depression. Kevin Carter did, in fact, commit suicide in 1994, about 2 months after he received a Pulitzer Prize for this photo that he took. He was 33 years old, as the last slide indicated. I want to tell you a little bit more about Kevin Carter, because some of the things in this text are inaccurate. Some of it's not all that important, but I think some of it is. In the first place, the photo was not taken in 1994. It was taken in 1993. And it was only after it had circulated and been recognized among a number of magazines and newspapers, etc., that Kevin Carter was awarded this prize. But more importantly, Kevin Carter did not leave the scene immediately. By his own accounts, at least, he chased this vulture away. And he claimed that he sat against a tree there and cried because of the things that he was seeing, not just in this particular photo or in this particular scene, but what he had been seeing for several days outside this United Nations food camp. Kevin Carter had been watching an average of 20 people an hour die of famine as they're trying to reach this camp, and even some, obviously, who had managed to get there. Kevin Carter did not commit suicide 3 months after the taking of this picture. It was the next year, over a year later, that he committed suicide. And it's apparently not because of that picture that he took or that child's plight. Kevin Carter had become notorious in South Africa. He and three of his photographer friends, who had made it a practice of documenting in photography the violence that was going on under apartheid. And they were photographing murders and beatings and all sorts of injustice and violence. And it's apparent from some of the things that were written about Kevin Carter and even some of what he wrote himself, that eventually all of these things, all of this suffering, all of this injustice that he witnessed was too much. Too much for him to bear with the support system that he had. And yet, despite the inaccuracies of some of the things that are said here, the implication is that he's heartless, that he abandoned the child, that then he became depressed and killed himself because of that particular action. Those things are apparently not true. And yet the picture is disturbing. It is emotionally wrenching. And I want to talk to you a little bit about my reaction to the photo. In my office, and it comes up on my computer screen. And as I looked at the photo, I wondered, first of all, where are her parents? She's alone. Where are her parents? Well, most likely they're dead. They're probably victims also of the same famine that I feel fairly certain probably claimed her life. But as a parent myself, I couldn't help but think of how fortunate I am, and my wife, of course, also, as parents, that we never had to deal with that kind of a situation with our sons. We really never had to watch our children go without the necessities of life. My two sons grew up from the time they were born to the time that they left home, never knowing hunger. Oh, there were a couple of times when they decided they didn't want to eat what Debbie cooked. And the policy was, if you don't eat that, you don't eat anything. And they discovered that Mom and Dad were pretty adamant about that, so they went all night without eating, and they were glad to eat breakfast. That's the only hunger they ever experienced, to my knowledge. We were able to provide them day after day, year, through their entire childhood, with all of the things they needed, clothing and food and shelter. And we were able to provide for them some opportunities and pleasures and privileges that you provide for your children also. Like Debbie and myself, many of you have taken your children to Walt Disney World in Florida. Some of you were there this last week. You had an opportunity to bring joy into your children's lives. And that's a wonderful feeling as a parent to be able to do that and to provide these things for your children. But I also thought of my own blessings. As I'm looking at a whole different world, a whole different climate, economic climate, I'm reminded of the very fact that Noble and David reminded us of this morning, that we are incredibly blessed. But I wonder if frequently I don't take that for granted. And I began to think of all of the blessings. I couldn't have picked a better song. Counting the various ways in which I'm blessed. And I want to illustrate that for you by just talking about this morning. That's really all it'll take for any of us, I think, is to just think about what you did this morning. I'll tell you what I did. I woke up in safety in my own temperature-controlled home, in a comfortable bed. I didn't fear for my life. Got up and I went into the kitchen and I ate breakfast. I had enough to eat. I chose what I wanted to eat. I ate what I had without having to fight somebody else for it. And it came out of a pantry that has food for days. Debbie and I could eat off of the licorice for a week and a half. And I got myself ready for services this morning. I went into the privacy of our own bathroom. I had clean water. I was able to clean my body in comfort, in privacy, in safety. I went into our closet and I chose what I wanted to wear this morning. And I chose from a variety of things that I could have worn. All of the latest fashion, if you believe that. But nice clothes. Newer clothes. Clean clothes. And then when it was time for us to go, after I'd sat down and read the paper, found out what was going on in the world, getting the important news, both Alabama and Auburn won yesterday, sat in front of my computer and got some news, did a little bit of work. And then Debbie and I went from our house to our garage in safety. We didn't have to worry about someone waiting for us or the fear of violence outside. We got into a car, a temperature-controlled car, not a wagon. We didn't climb on an animal. We got in a vehicle that conveyed us swiftly and safely and comfortably to this place, where we're sitting on padded pews in a temperature-controlled building without fear that somebody's going to come in and drag some of us away. Here's the bottom line. I didn't spend an uncomfortable moment this morning. Everything I did, everything that I engaged in was set up exactly the way I wanted it. I was thinking about this morning. Some of you, when we greet each other, you say, "How you doing?" And I'll tell you, after thinking about this sermon this morning, I just wanted to just hug you and say, "I'm doing great. My life is that good." And I'll tell you what, I'm suspicious that most of you have the same kind of life. Maybe you didn't read about the football games, but I'm willing to bet that you woke up in your bed. You didn't wake up on the floor or on a dirt floor. You didn't have to fight somebody else for a blanket because you were living outside in the cold in the wintertime like they are up in Tibet. Those who are survivors, survivors of an earthquake that destroyed families and buildings and left people with nothing. And they're trying to survive now, much less rebuild what's lost. We are so incredibly blessed. But I want to talk to you about what I think are some possible reactions to that fact and some possible reactions to the photo that I showed you. I think sometimes it would be easy for us to feel guilty because we have what we have. In fact, I would suggest to you that some almost preach the sinfulness of wealth. That somehow I am sinful because I have more material blessings than others. And I think that's wrong. I don't believe the Scriptures teach that. Was Abraham sinful because he was wealthy? Job, richest man in the East, complimented so incredibly highly by God in Job chapter 1. Was he sinful because he was a rich man? Were there not poor people living in Job's time? Obviously. And we could just run through the pages of the Old Testament Scriptures and talk about David, King David, and his wealth. Was he sinful because he was a rich man? And Solomon, whom God blessed with the wealth, even as he blessed these others, was he sinful because he was wealthy? Should he have felt guilty because he had more than others had? Turn in your Bibles to 1 Timothy, the 6th chapter. And I want you to note carefully with me, beginning in verse 17, the instructions that Paul writes to Timothy that he ought to give to the rich. Beginning in verse 17 of 1 Timothy 6, Paul wrote, "Command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Let them do good that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share." Paul doesn't tell Timothy that he ought to condemn the wealthy because they have more than others. He said, don't trust in those riches. And you need to be willing to share with others. You need to make sure your faith is in God, not in your possessions. But there is apparently no sin in being wealthy. How many of you have heard this expression, money is the root of all evil? That's a misquote, isn't it? In fact, in this very same chapter, in 1 Timothy, the 6th chapter, and verse 10, here's the right quote, "For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Money is not sinful. It's just a means of exchange. It doesn't have any moral qualities. But now the love of money, as Paul says, is the root of all kinds of evil. And men have committed many sins because of their love of money. Matthew, the 19th chapter, beginning in verse 16, records the story of a rich young ruler who came to Jesus wanting to know what things he needed to do or what thing he needed to do in order to have eternal life. Matthew, the 19th chapter, verse 16. And Jesus responded to him, "If you want to enter into life, keep the commandments." And the young man said, "Which ones?" Jesus cited several of the commandments. And the young man said in verse 20, "All these things I've kept from my youth. What do I still lack?" And Jesus said, "If you want to be perfect, go sell what you have and give to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." We need to be careful that we don't take that statement or those instructions out of the context of the story and misapply them to suggest that the only way that you and I can become righteous or be good disciples is basically to divest ourselves of all material possessions. There are plenty of people who will be willing to help you with that. We have to understand that in the context here, this young man had a particular problem with his possessions. They were his life. And of course, he goes away sorrowful Because he's not willing to part with those things that had essentially become first priority in his life. They'd become his God. He was afflicted with the love of things, of money. And Jesus, looking into his heart, understood that. And those instructions were designed for his particular circumstances. Now, we may find ourselves in the same situation. I'm not saying that's impossible. I'm saying those instructions relate to the condition of his heart. And if we're willing to share those things that we have, to follow Paul's instructions to the rich, and later on in 1 Timothy chapter 6, there's no sin in being wealthy. I'll tell you, there's another response or possible reaction to this photo or to the suffering of others, and that is kind of a self-congratulatory attitude. The idea of, I'm sure glad that it's her and not me that has to crawl to a refugee center or has to beg for food or is starving to death. Now, I'll be honest with you, I'm glad that I'm not in that situation. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about an attitude where it's not a question of, I'm just glad I don't have to be that, but I'm glad that it's her, not me. And that is a selfish attitude. It is an attitude of unconcern. Are we unconcerned about those who are in these situations simply because we've been able to avoid such difficulty in our own lives? I was fortunate enough to be born in this country. I had no control over that. I didn't choose my parents, nor their economic circumstances. But I was fortunate enough to be born in a place where I didn't have to face some of those things. Is that all that I feel about it? I'm just glad I've got what I've got. And so I'm unconcerned about those who have less. Remember Paul's instructions to the rich, willing to share. Paul says it's not enough just to be glad for what you've got, but you must be willing to share. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. And then another attitude, and that's simply to turn a blind eye. And I will tell you, this is tempting. There may be even some of you here this morning who are upset that I would show a photograph like that because it's disturbing to us. You see, the tendency of mankind is to look the other way and to pretend that those things don't happen. I surround myself with my own goods and my own luxury, my good life, and as long as it's all off in another country, geographically distant from me, I can ignore it. And when the television shows that kind of stuff, I just switch the channel. I turn the blind eye. I don't like to think about the fact that there are people who are suffering like that little girl and, of course, millions of others. And we may even excuse ourselves for doing that by saying, well, I can't do anything to help that little girl. And that's probably true. I really believe that's the way Kevin Carter felt. By his own admission, he didn't pick that girl up and carry her to the refugee camp. He shooed away the bird, and he cried because of his own sadness and what he'd been seeing and dealing with, and then he left. We don't know what happened to the girl. I'm assuming she died. But I think I understand why he didn't do anything. He couldn't help all those people. And that's a common attitude. It's a common reason for doing nothing because I can't change everything. And so I just turn the blind eye and I take care of myself and my family and my friends and my brethren. And the rest of the world is just going to have to take care of itself. I don't think we can help certain circumstances. I haven't done a thing to help the people in Tibet. I'm not sure how I would start. But can we not help those who are, in fact, closer to us? This is not a sermon of criticism because I know how generous and liberal you have been in certain circumstances, even in the recent circumstances of the destruction of Katrina. and Rita. And I know that some of you took time off from work and you went and you helped and you provided things, and others donated money. Ashley Rumpf gave an entire summer's earnings. I think it was a lemonade stand that she operated, and she made some money. And she asked if she could give the money. That's a heart that's being trained. I just wonder sometimes if we're not overwhelmed by the suffering in this world. And the media really is a willing conspirator in this, because the media doesn't tell us about a lot of the success stories and all the good things that are going on in the world around us. In fact, it tends to focus on the bad things, because that's really what people want to hear. We have this morbid curiosity. It's why people slow down when they pass a car accident. It's not anybody they know necessarily. They just want to see if there's somebody out on the road dead. People are like that. It's because there's a certain morbidity about us that revels in bad news. And the media is willing to gratify that. And so they tell us about all of the destruction and every kook who's out there doing something that's just absolutely horrible. We'll learn about it. We'll read about it. And we'll see pictures of it. And I want to tell you that if we're not careful, we can become just like Kevin Carter. Overwhelmed with circumstances that we can't seem to change. And so it just beats us up. I want to talk to you just for a moment or two, not very long at all, because we've suggested these things already, about what our proper reaction should be to our physical blessings. And obviously we ought to be thankful. So many passages in the Bible that emphasize this point again and again. The seriousness of the sin of ingratitude on our part. And the need to be thankful for all of the things. Here, just a triad of scriptures. 1 Timothy, the 4th chapter, and verse 3. Paul writes that some would be forbidding to marry and commanding to abstain from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. God put these things on this earth for our use. Why should we feel guilty that we are using them? That's God's intention. But it is His intention that we receive them with thanksgiving, that we don't forget who the giver of the gift is. In Colossians, the 2nd chapter, in verse 7, we're to be rooted and built up in Christ and established in the faith as you have been taught, abounding in it with thanksgiving. The New American Standard Version has a wonderful translation here. It says, overflowing with gratitude. Ever met somebody like that? You do something for them and they just can't thank you enough. In fact, it gets embarrassing. After a while, you just kind of, you're almost ashamed to have them there lauding, oh, I'm so thankful. But that's overflowing with gratitude, isn't it? Gushing, even. That's what we ought to be about the things that we have. We're fortunate. We're very blessed. And that's by the hand of God. In Ephesians, the 5th chapter, verse 18, this long sentence, Paul says, don't be drunk with wine, in which is dissipation, but in contrast, be filled with the Spirit. And then in verses 19 and 20, there are three major participles that describe what it means to be filled with the Spirit, what the consequence of that is. He says, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody in your hearts to the Lord, giving thanks always for all things to God the Father in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Giving thanks always for all things. Count your many blessings. Name them one by one to God. And then in addition to our thankfulness, there needs to be the willingness to share with others. I am not suggesting that we hand over all of our possessions to anyone who's waiting for a handout. I think we need to remember what Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10. He said, if any will not work, neither should he eat. I think there are some people who ought not to be helped. They ought to go hungry because they're unwilling to help themselves. They live off of the grace of others, off of the liberality of others, but they're not responsible And by helping them, all we do is encourage them in that same behavior, which tends to incidentally repeat itself generation after generation in certain families and cultures. But at the same time, don't forget what the sin of the rich farmer was in the parable of Luke 12. He was rich because God blessed him. God made the sun shine and the rains come down, and his ground produced a lot of crops. No sin there. That's God's doing through nature. But he is criticized in the very end of that story by Jesus as being one who was not rich toward God. What was the problem? Well, he wanted to keep everything for himself. Is Jesus saying that what he should have done is he should have gone to some church and put the money in a collection plate? Is that how you're rich toward God? Well, obviously, that's one way in which you can support the cause of the gospel. You can certainly do that. But you know what this man's problem was? He didn't help his fellow man. And now I'm reminded of Matthew, the 25th chapter, that scene of judgment where the Lord compliments those who are righteous, saying, "You did this to me, and you did this to me, and you did this to me." And they said, "When did we see you in these conditions? Needy and naked and sick." And he said, "When you did it to your fellow man, to the least of these, you did it to me." And so you and I can be rich toward God, the failure of the rich man, by helping our fellow man. And that's a proper response to what we have. And again, I'm not being critical. I know of your liberality. I also know how easy it is to forget, to become complacent, and to begin to trust in riches, in things that have no future, that will be consumed by fire in the end. I really believe that Kevin Carter, the photographer, was a victim of a deep and persistent sadness that came in part because he saw constantly man's injustice to man, the suffering that people find in this world, even sometimes just as a result of natural law, but not because of man's inhumanity. And the difficulty is that he didn't know how to deal with that. He immersed himself in something that was too much for his support system. Aren't you glad that we have a spiritual family to help us deal with those kinds of emotional difficulties? And I want to say to you that our response to our physical blessings needs to be thanksgiving, but much more than that. There needs to be a feeling of wanting to help others. Not necessarily financially. There are people who are suffering, and what they need is understanding. What they need is friendship. What they need is compassion. They have money. That's not what they need. What they need is what you and I can provide. And in light of our own blessings and the comfort of our own lives, we need to be sharing with others. Benevolence is a word that has been hijacked because it has come to mean only money or the giving of physical assistance. But benevolence just talks about specifically the idea of wishing well for others. And it carries with it the idea of carrying through with that and helping people in what their needs are. And I will tell you that the greatest need of anybody is salvation. That's the greatest blessing that we can share with others, is just to tell them about the gospel. How sad it would be for us as a people, as a nation, in all of our prosperity and our wealth, our luxury, to just close our eyes to all of the suffering that's going on around the world, all the need, just say, "Well, that's not our problem. We've got ours." And our country hasn't done that, incidentally. The United States is one of the most generous countries that has ever existed in terms of helping other people. When we talk about that, of course, the government does a lot of that. But that money doesn't come from the government. It comes out of your pockets and comes out of my pockets. But I'll tell you what's worse. It's for us to enjoy fellowship with God and decide that we're going to keep that for ourselves and we're going to ignore a whole world around us who needs what we've got. Will we share it? Or will we just live with the attitude of, well, I've got mine? This morning, if you need the gospel, because you've never obeyed the gospel and you're separated from God by your own sins, understand that God's greatest blessing is the fellowship that is restored when we're forgiven of our sins. God wipes away all of the stains, the guilt of sin. He provides us with hope and peace. He provides us with a way out of temptation. And eventually He will provide us with life eternal. If you need to obey the gospel this morning, there's no good reason not to do that. If you believe with all your heart that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, why not obey Him today? Become one of His spiritual children. Or perhaps you're a Christian who needs to be restored, has gotten wrapped up in the things of the world and begun to trust in other things besides trusting in God. Then why not this morning make yourself right with God? Dedicate yourself again. If you need the prayers of the congregation, we will pray with you. Whatever your need is this morning, we ask you to respond. Come to the front. We'll assist you even as we stand to encourage you in song. Shall we sing?